Item one, Deutsche Bank is not Lehman Brothers. Item two, yeah, I know that, but still. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, September the 30th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. While noting for the record that this is 2016, not 2008, we lead today with a story that is not all that comforting financial crisis-wise. As I mentioned yesterday, Deutsche Bank, the biggest bank in the biggest economy in Europe, is in some trouble. There are questions about how real that trouble is, but if we learned anything in 2008, it's that perceptions of trouble matter. We're going to talk about it all in a minute with John Carney and Lee Gallagher. But first, from the European desk in London Marketplace's Stephen Beard is going to give us the Deutsche Bank background.
Some analysts blame the US for Deutsche Bank's current distress. Chris Ralph is with the St. James Place investment firm. He says it was the $14 billion settlement demanded by the Department of Justice for the mis-selling of mortgage-backed securities that shattered investor confidence in the bank.
This is a problem that's been created by regulators rather than by poor trading on the bank's behalf.
And he says that $14 billion figure sounds suspiciously like retaliation.
Somebody suggested to me that the size of the Deutsche Bank fine related to the size of the EU tax fine on Apple, and it was sort of tit for tat.
But Deutsche Bank has been struggling ever since the 2008 financial crisis. Its biggest competitor, Commerzbank, is also in trouble. Many European banks still suffer from insufficient capital, bad debts, overstaffing, and too much involvement in risky investment banking. They haven't cleaned house, says Professor John Kay of the London School of Economics.
In continental Europe, there was an unwillingness to face up to the very fundamental problems which Europe had in its banking system after the global financial crisis.
So what's to be done about Deutsche Bank? German Chancellor Angela Merkel can hardly bail it out. She spent the last few years telling the Greeks and the Italians that bank bailouts are verboten. Independent banking analyst Francis Coppola says Deutsche Bank's best hope, oddly enough, is the DOJ.
Department of Justice is not going to want to impose a fine on this bank that's going to break it, because that ripples back to the United States.
Ripples? More like a tidal wave if Deutsche Bank collapses. The bank is believed to hold about 10% of the world's derivatives, $50 trillion worth. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As promised, John Carney from The Wall Street Journal, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hey ho, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, John, let's start with you, this idea. So, first of all, Deutsche Bank seems more stable today than it did yesterday. Yesterday seemed to have been the moment of maximum angst, I guess. What's your gut, though, on contagion and things for people to be worried about?
Well, look, we saw this again, you know, as you said, it's not 2008, right, but we did see this play out in 2008, too, where we had a lot of panic and then you would get moments of calm. Today, there were rumors that the fine might not be as big as $14 yep. billion. Dollars. It may be half that or even smaller. And so that, you know, was reassuring to people. But again, I'm not sure we don't, you know, wake up Monday morning with people, you know, once again, you know, climbing towards wow. maximal fear.
Well, I'll tell you what, and that's interesting, Lee, because if you remember the moments of maximal fear in 2008, they all happened on the weekends, if you remember.
They did.
We were all like,
they
no,
did.
Man,
that Saturday
on.
In
Saturday
September.
Afternoon.
I will
yeah.
never forget it. I will never yeah. forget it. But I mean, you know, it was many players. It wasn't just one institution. It was there was a sort of the sense of contagion that was kind of everywhere. Obviously, Lehman was the big one, but it was a very widespread problem with the products and with the things that had been
right.
created. I mean, you know, so I think this is much not as much to worry about.
The idea, though, that European banks, Lee, are not did not learn the lessons as well from the financial crisis as American banks did. Do you buy that?
Did anyone learn the yeah. lessons? I mean, you know, you can never. The funny thing, I mean, the problems are always going to reemerge in a different place mm-hmm, than you mm-hmm. expect them, which is what I think is so interesting about the Wells Fargo situation.
Exactly.
I don't think that Europe learned the lesson of sort of fortress capitalization that we have forced on our banks. Hmm. You know, the banks complain, they say, and people say, oh, capital requirements are so high. But we're seeing right now with Deutsche Bank is the consequence of having perhaps insufficient capital, mm-hmm. because what happens when investors start to get worried, both their counterparties, you know, start we've had a couple reports of funds pulling their money mm-hmm. out of Deutsche mm-hmm. Bank, and you know the stock has gone from, you know, $100 down to, you know, 10% of that.
It's that idea of the fortress balance sheet, right? That if investors decide to pull all their money out, the bank can withstand it.
Right. That, yeah. you know, that the bank and it can take losses. You know, I mean, our right. banks have mm-hmm. paid tens of billions of dollars of fines to our regulators as well.
Right.
The fact that you might have a fine that could cripple you means you're already too weak.
Yeah. So, Lee, let's make that transition then to American banks, specifically Wells Fargo and John Stumpf. Probably the worst 10 days he's had in a long, long time. kind of amazing he's still around, right?
Yes, it is. And, I mean, yesterday it was a spectacle. But, you know, if you say the defense is so, I mean, that this is, our culture is one of trust. You know, this is some rogue employees. It was 5,300. It clearly is the culture. It clearly is the culture. And, you know, he is the CEO and the head of the board, and there were some serious board failures here as well. Everything from, you know, overseeing compensation, making sure it doesn't encourage bad behavior. You know, the board oversees culture also, and he sort of said, well, I didn't have much to do with that.
Yeah, and
the compensation.
Right, but also, if you look at all the things that Dodd-Frank was supposed to have taken care of, they didn't take care, Lee, of this cross-selling issue and the idea that retail banking is somehow now a problem area.
No, because who would think? It's retail banking. I mean, right. you know, we tried to plug so many other holes that seem so complicated, and then this thing happens, and it's sort of, you know, and the dangerous thing about it is this is something that everyone in their living rooms can understand. I mean, synthetic mm-hmm. CDOs, you had to explain a lot. But this, you know, somebody's creating something in my name and I didn't okay it. I mean, right. it's so plain and simple.
The other problem is it's customer facing, right? Like
right,
when
right, right.
Goldman had its Abacus scandal or the London Whale trade at JPM.
Man, remember that.
This affected customers, which are also called constituents if you're a congressman. And that explains some of the outrage we're seeing.
Right. John Carney at The Wall Street Journal and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks to you both.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. The money that Deutsche Bank investors lost yesterday, by the way, they mostly got back today. Ditto for the major indices. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, totally different direction now from 2008. How about that? Just because you can never have enough coffee options, Dunkin' Donuts says it's going to launch a line of bottled coffee drinks early next year. Coca-Cola is going to manufacture, distribute, and sell the Dunkin'-branded beverage, the donut maker's first foray into ready-to-drink coffee, by the by. They're not the first, though, by a long shot. Starbucks and Pepsi teamed up more than 20 years ago to launch Starbucks' bottled Frappuccinos. But Gigi Dubin reports this is a good time to be in bottled coffee.
Here's the good thing about bottled coffee. You can pop into the gas station or the drugstore or even a bulk retailer and grab yourself some. And coffee companies, big and small, want in on this grab-and-go goodness.
Bottled coffee ready to drink is a hugely exploding market in the U.S.
Spencer Torr is VP of the Vermont firm Coffee Analysts. He says Dunkin' Donuts already sells ground coffee and single-serve cups at retail outlets. But Coca-Cola, with its vast national distribution network, will help get the bottled stuff into more hands.
This is a great opportunity to bring their products to consumers who don't live near stores.
And it's an opportunity for Coca-Cola and Pepsi, which partnered with Starbucks on bottled Frappuccinos. Soft drink sales have slumped, so companies like Coke and Pepsi are turning to flavored water, energy drinks, even milk. David Henkes is a beverage analyst with Technomic.
They're really now beverage companies. They're not necessarily carbonated soft drink companies.
But if you've ever stood in line at a coffee shop and listened to people's orders, you know how annoyingly particular people can be. Now try bottling that.
So the trick is really to develop a product that kind of can bridge that.
Gary Hemphill is managing director of research for Beverage Marketing Corporation. He's not saying Dunkin' Donuts has to make a product that's all things to all people, but it definitely has to have mass appeal. I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
There was, without getting down too deep in the technical nitty-gritty, there was a huge distributed denial of service attack this week on a well-known internet security writer and his website. Basically, hackers overwhelmed it with traffic, and they did it, indications are, by using regular, everyday hardware, routers and internet cameras and DVRs that are hooked up to what has come to be called the Internet of Things, which does raise the, boy, this could happen to anybody question of what are the companies that make all these smart devices doing to protect themselves and protect us? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
In the brave new Internet of Things, everything's connected to the internet. Your TV, your thermostat. For cheaper stuff, companies may decide not to spend the money for extra security, says attorney Lee Tien of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So if you're making, say, a new fitness tracker,
it would be a lot easier and a lot cheaper to design it without having encrypted storage, without all sorts of things that some people think you need to have.
Because security is pricey and consumers want cheap gadgets. Security consultant Barrett Lyon says when a company first rolls out a product,
oh, you could spend tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars making sure that the first release is secure.
So then the next question is, do you keep it secure and for how long? For the life of a product? To do that, a company has to send out expensive patches when holes in security are discovered. Some of the bigger, more reputable companies do that. They'll even pay professional hackers to try to find bugs.
I think bug bounties are a great idea.
That's Darren Hayes. He teaches computer security at Pace University. And yes, he said bug bounties.
And these bug bounties are devised to offer rewards to people who find a vulnerability in their product and inform the company, and then they get a reward.
The upshot? Hayes says if you want your connected fridge, thermostat, or DVR to be secure, you'll have to pay more because for those products, high quality means more security. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we were building a facility that was meant essentially to last forever.
Because one thing you never want to run out of is food. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 164 points on this Friday, 0.9%, closed at 18,308. The NASDAQ up 42 points, 0.8%, ended at 5312. The S&P 500 up 17 points, again, 0.8%. 21 and 68. For the week gone by, the 5 days that were, the Dow up 0.25%, the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 added 0.1%. Warehouse club operator Costco bulked up 3 4/10% today as it posted better than expected profits and earnings, including me twice a month. Other consumer stocks also fared well. Walmart stacked up almost 2% today. Procter & Gamble skipped up 1.7%. Banks rebounded, as I mentioned, as concerns eased about the financial health of Germany's Deutsche Bank, although Carney with that weekend thing does kind of make you wonder. Deutsche Bank up 6.4% today. Citigroup up 0.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Florida and presidential elections. How much more does one really need to say? It's a swing state, the richest electoral vote count swing state, of course, just a very big deal on November the 8th. So the campaigns are spending a lot of time and money gaming out how best to convince voters their candidate is the one. This year, though, thanks to the Puerto Rican economy, there is a new constituency that they're going to have to convince in Florida. American citizens who've left the island settled in Central Florida and are voting for president for the first time. Marketplace's Andy Euler went down there to see what those new voters are thinking.
Thousands of Puerto Ricans have settled over the past couple of decades in a town south of Orlando near Disney World called Kissimmee. People there tell you if you want to get a sense of this place's Puerto Rican community, you go here, Malau Bakery. Before I get inside to check out what flavors of pasteles this place has, I'm greeted by Wilfredo Ramirez. We say hi in Spanish, and he asks me if I'm registered to vote. Not normally the first thing a new acquaintance asks, but Wilfredo's on a mission. He moved here from Puerto Rico just a few months ago and has a job registering people to vote.
It's a bit confusing. Puerto Ricans are considered U.S. citizens, but it's not the same as being born in the U.S. as opposed to Puerto Rico.
Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, but because of its territory status, those on the island can't vote for president. They hold a presidential primary, but that's where it ends. If they come to the mainland and establish residency, they get to vote in November. Wilfredo's been at the bakery for a couple of hours, and he says he's talked to a lot of Puerto Ricans.
I've interviewed or talked to more than 150 people.
His contract will have him here in Central Florida through November. The group he's with, Hispanic Federation, isn't affiliated with any party, but they've been vocal about Donald Trump's immigration statements, calling them misleading, demeaning, and unfounded. Wilfredo says his job is necessary because voting in Puerto Rico is different, and most of these people just got here.
Almost everyone that I've talked to and asked whether they live here say they're newly arrived.
And the main issue there is whether Puerto Rico should stay a territory, become a state, or assert independence. Jose Rivera moved here from the island in 1994. He's an engineer and in favor of independence.
It's about time we honor our own destiny. We are the 32-year-old guy that still lives with mom and dad, and we're expecting mom and dad to fix all of our broken plates.
Carlos Vargas Ramos is a researcher at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. He says the Puerto Rican migration to Florida wouldn't affect the election if groups weren't out there explaining what's going on.
In general, were it were anywhere else, where there's not a mobilization effort, those Puerto Ricans would be less likely to turning out to vote. But because precisely they're going to be targets, they will be in play.
And the presidential campaigns know that. Florida's a battleground state, and besides spending on TV, the Clinton campaign's been focused on trying to get people registered to vote. And what they're finding is that recent migrants aren't necessarily as democratic as they once assumed. Republicans, to their relief, say they're seeing the same thing. Mark Oxner is chairman of the Osceola County Republicans, where 60% of the Hispanic population identify as Puerto Rican.
The big thing is, you know, they're not coming all Democrats. You know, most of them come over and sign as MPAs.
That's no party affiliation, another way of saying independent voters, which makes it a little more difficult for Democrats and Republicans to directly identify supporters. That means it'll probably be more expensive to get those independent voters to pick a side. But in this part of Central Florida, the community's biggest concerns are extremely local. For newly arrived Puerto Ricans, they need teachers in schools who can help kids transition to living on the mainland. That means teachers who are bilingual. Pablo Casares, director of the Puerto Rican Federal Affairs Administration, a Puerto Rican governmental arm with an office in Kissimmee, says that's what he hears all the time.
The issues that are most important for us, the Puerto Rican community, that we need to obviously start talking about is having good quality education for our kids. And there are also other big issues like immigration.
At the same time, a lot of Puerto Ricans left the island and came here because things were so bad. Unemployment is twice that of the mainland. Almost half the population is living under the poverty line. Hospitals are limiting hours because they can't pay for electricity, and schools are closing because teachers aren't getting paid. Now that they have a vote, some migrants feel like they might have an impact on what Washington does about their homes' crippling debt crisis. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Svalbard, Norway, is where we're going next. It's just a little bit colder than Florida, being as it is well north of the Arctic Circle, and therein lies the reason we're bringing it up. If you want to preserve something, you put it on ice, right? And that is basically what happens at the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. More than 500 million seeds collected from all over the world, just in case. Kerry Fowler is the driving force behind the vault, and he has written a new book about the project called Seeds on Ice. And when we spoke, I asked him why exactly it is that we need a seed vault in the first place.
To put this into context, I think that agriculture is really facing a historically unprecedented combination of challenges. So we obviously have climate issues. You don't even have to believe in climate change to understand we had an extremely hot year last year, and this poses some real problems for farmers and our crops in the field. So all of these things are issues that our agriculture system is going to have to deal with, and more particularly our crops are going to have to adapt to. And the way they adapt to them is through the diversity that's found in our crops. Mm. Our plant breeders and scientists and farmers produce new varieties that are adapted to these conditions.
So you flip through some of the pictures in this book, which are amazing, because Svalbard is very far away and the landscape is kind of amazing. But then the pictures inside the vault are basically sort of like the Home Depot shelves that I can get and put in my garage, right? And it's just boxes and boxes and boxes of seeds.
One of the things that we figured out pretty early on was that we were building a facility almost unlike any facility for any purpose anywhere in the world. Right. In that we were building a facility that was meant essentially to last forever. And we realized that to be sustainable, it had to be very pragmatic, very practical, and cheap. Because if it was going to be expensive to run, it probably wasn't going to be sustainable. Right. So it's not a antiseptic laboratory with people running around in white coats. It's a very bare-bones facility that just does its job and does it very economically.
Well, and I was looking at your website. The United States has, what's the number, 17,892,091 seeds as of the last update of this website.
Well, not to be too precise, but yeah, about that.
And where do they come from? I mean, does the Department of Agriculture send you guys a crate full every, 2 months?
Well, they just made a deposit. So,
is that right?
Yeah, they did. I think about 20,000 additional samples came in from the United States. They mostly come from our own National Seed Bank, which is in Fort Collins, Colorado. But originally, these seeds were sourced from all over the world. So if you look at where the seeds in the seed vault have come from, I think they've come from something like 232 different countries.
Hmm. Do you keep an eye on, flooding and hurricanes and natural disasters and all of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in a sense, the early warning system for the potential loss of crop diversity in seed banks is NPR and CNN, whenever you see some kind of trouble.
Sorry.
something is maybe happening. And frankly, we've had some cases where we've had national seed banks either partially or almost completely destroyed. Afghanistan and Iraq, those seed banks got caught in the middle of something. Mm. So we always need a plan B.
Huh. In point of fact, just talking about war zones and Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria just made the first ever withdrawal, right?
Well, it was an international center that used to be headquartered outside of Aleppo, Syria. It was a really important center, is a really important research facility, which had a major collection of wheat, barley, lentils, chickpeas, a wonderful little crop that I love called grass pea. But when the war came to Syria, the researchers had to abandon the site, and they moved their facilities to Morocco and Lebanon. So last September, they needed their seed back. I think in that one repatriation event, we really paid for the cost of constructing this facility and showed its value down the road.
Kerry Fowler is the head of the International Council that oversees the Global Seed Vault. His book about it is called Seeds on Ice. Kerry, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
There is a link to Kerry Fowler's book, which really is worth it for the pictures alone. They are kind of amazing. It's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, brought to you by corporate synergy gone kind of sideways. Target sold its in-store pharmacy business to CVS last year for almost $2 billion. So far, so good. Straight ahead deal. But this week, we learned CVS is going to get rid of Target's totally innovative twist on prescription drug bottles, ClearRx. It's called, you might have seen them. Great looking design, all kinds of features to prevent misdosing of meds or people taking the wrong pills because they're all in those generic orangey bottles with the white push and twist tops on them. You know what I'm talking about. ClearRx pills, those bottles rather, they're in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. They won the Design of the Decade Award from the Industrial Design Society of America.
And yet, CVS says it needs to align everything with its 9,600 existing stores, which you get, but still. I'll deny this if y'all repeat it, but here's hoping John Carney is wrong and we wake up Monday morning and Deutsche Bank is just fine, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 0.9% today. The NASDAQ up 0.8%. The S&P 500 up 0.8% as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. All right? Oh, yeah, this is 8 p.m.